Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for coming. Welcome to the yet another event in Development Week at the LSE. Thanks to the Student Society for helping to organize, for taking the lead in organizing all of these events. I'm Jean-Paul Figuet from the Development Studies Institute, and I'm very, very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Ian Golden, Vice President for External Affairs at the World Bank. Dr. Golden is someone who spans the world of academia, real development action through development organizations, and also the private sector. Before being at the World Bank, he is actually an LSE alum. He did his MSc here before doing his PhD at Oxford, his DPhil at Oxford. He's been at the South African Development Community. He also worked as Director of Commodities at LMC London, has been an advisor to Nelson Mandela, has served in a number of other crucial capacities, both in the developing world and the private sector. He's author of 11 books and over 40 referee journal papers in development and economics journals. So without further ado, I give you Dr. Ian Golden. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you to so many of you for being here. This is quite a historic occasion for me personally, because I was last in this room, I hate to admit, about 25 years ago doing my MSc. And it's also a historical day for other reasons, and I'm sure many of you have been on Trafalgar Square today celebrating the campaign Make Poverty History. And it's a tremendous time for, I think, people to be able to engage in politics in a way that will bring change to the world that is so poverty-oriented. And I was last in Trafalgar Square with Mandela when he came on a state visit. Some of you might remember, I think it was 1997. At that time, it was during his presidency, getting a campaign going was beginning to be talked about, but not yet a reality. And prior to that, of course, many of us had been in Trafalgar Square singing Free Nelson Mandela in the 80s and in the 70s. And so being at LSE, and having walked over from this lecture theatre many times to Trafalgar Square to join rallies against apartheid to free Nelson Mandela, and going back today was particularly meaningful for me. And it really is a pleasure to talk about development today and to try and give some dimensions which I hope complement the many others that you've had during this development week. And I would like to congratulate Alan and the others who have put this week together, because it really is the key to making poverty history, that ideas are developed, that ideas churn. And the one thing that I think I feel stronger and stronger as time goes by, that what will really make a difference, what will really end poverty and bring development, is the power of ideas. And that's why being engaged with students and talking around development ideas is absolutely the most important thing that I think we can be doing with our time as we build this constituency. This is the year of development. Tomorrow, the finance ministers will be meeting to focus on particular issues, and this is part of a broad campaign going through the whole year, which is aiming to make very significant advances. The expectations are very, very high, and what I think is crucial in thinking about these expectations is that they are calibrated against what is possible to achieve in 1 year, what has been achieved over the last 20, 40 years, and where do we think we'll be in 2015 when the Millennium Development Goals are achieved. I think the most striking thing in the realm of ideas when one looks back is just how much our understanding of development has changed. When I was a student here, people were talking about development as income poverty. It was really all about per capita GDP. It was about growth and income relationships. And the broad concept of development we have now, the development as freedom, in Amartya Sen's words, development as empowerment, development as the right to define your own lives, was not center stage in the debate. And so one of the things we've had a huge advance in is this broader understanding of development. And that has gone with an evolution, of course, in the way that states think. When I was here, it was the Thatcher, Reagan, Kohl years. The private sector and the idea that states get out of markets was very much in the ascendancy. and in the World Bank and in other institutions, it was the time of get your prices right. And you know about the shocks that many countries have gone through in those processes, when the ideology of getting your prices right was seen to be the key to unleashing the private sector. And now, of course, the pendulum has swung, and we know that it's going to be the governments, states, that have to establish the enabling framework in order to ensure that the private sector, which of course is the only part of the economy that can really generate jobs. We're not relying on governments to generate employment and growth. We're relying on them to facilitate it, to create the enabling environment, and that is absolutely central in terms of this evolution. And so when we think of the MDGs, it's very important, although these are very clearly defined targets around income poverty, halving poverty by 2015, around some key other dimensions of development on health, on education, on HIV/AIDS, is to think of these as a snapshot, as one way of measuring development, but clearly not a full picture. It's not painted in. It's just the outline of some of the things that can be achieved, some of the targets to be achieved. And what's key when we drive this development agenda together with countries is to ensure that these other dimensions which aren't captured, like human rights, like gender empowerment in broader senses, are indeed part of the agenda. And so the MDGs carry with them the danger of simplification, as does, of course, all our campaigns and our work. And what I'd like to do is having put up this health warning, continue to focus on just how much of these will be achieved. When we think of the scale of the challenge, and again, emphasizing that this is only one way to measure it, we often refer to dollar a day measures. There have been long debates, including with Amartya Sen, as to whether the World Bank, which is the place which measures this, should drop this, and whether this is doing a positive or negative service. And I'd be happy to take questions on that and anything else in question time. But in the end, we think these are useful numbers because they do capture the imagination. But they also, of course, are subject to many other variables: exchange rate shocks, measurement questions, purchasing power parity versus nominal exchange rate, etc., etc. But on that basis, we think about 1.1 billion people are living under a dollar a day, about 2.7 billion people, which is well over half of all people living in developing countries under $2 a day. And all of those of you who are not on the dollar mentality but on the pound mentality will know that's about a coffee a day. You know, not, you won't get a pint of beer for what most people live on. In fact, you could barely get half a pint. So that is the aggregate income indice we're working on. Now, what is important when we look forward to 2015, I think, is to both be optimistic in the knowledge that these goals of halving this level of poverty are achievable, but also not to allow that optimism to dull the senses and to dull the campaigning and the action spirit in everyone, because these goals will only be achieved if the work on all of these MDGs at every level, globally, nationally, is accelerated. For the world as a whole, we think that the income poverty goal will be achieved largely driven out of India and China. But for Africa, of course, and I'll come back to that, this is going to be extremely difficult to achieve. And it would require growth rates of something like 7% per year from now until 2015 to get near the income poverty growth rate, income poverty reduction rate expected in the Millennium Development Goals. And we currently have an average of around 3.5%. So it's roughly a doubling of the growth rates in Africa is what's required. And that's not because growth itself translates into income reduction, but that's a broad catch all which allows us to with the elasticities, to think about some of the issues. Clearly, redistribution is important. Clearly, many of the other dimensions to this are important, and we'll come back to those. On some other dimensions of the Millennium Development Goals, health, education, environment, things look much worse. And we don't think any regions will achieve all the MDGs on current trends. So the challenge is not to continue as we are. The challenge is to think differently to ensure that there are new ideas, new ways of achieving these goals. And I remind you, as I'm sure those of you that have attended other lectures in the series know, that these are not the most ambitious goals. We're not talking about the elimination of world poverty. We're talking about halving world poverty by 2015. Indeed, some people have criticized the Millennium Development Goals for not being bold enough. So even those very low goals in terms of total poverty reduction are unlikely to be achieved in many key dimensions. In thinking about how these goals may be achieved, how poverty may be halved by 2015, what is extremely encouraging is both the looking back at some of the achievements made and trying to draw lessons from them, but also, very importantly, a new sense of togetherness, a new sense of shared understanding that has come about between the countries concerned who are going to be in the driving seat, the developing countries themselves, the international community, in the bilaterals, and institutions like the World Bank and others. And this was reflected in the Compact of the Millennium in 2000 and the Monterey Conference that followed, and a whole series of working groups that have followed from that. And this compact has, as we understand it, a number of key elements. One is that developing countries themselves are the only people in the end that can really drive their own futures and history. And this is not an externally driven question of development. So countries have to do it for themselves and are undertaking and are committed to undertake the necessary sort of reforms. Secondly, if they commit to undertake these reforms, the rest of the world, the rest of the global community will be supportive of those reforms. And they'll be supportive in a number of key dimensions. First, by establishing a global macro environment that is conducive to growth. Secondly, by trade reform, which will be conducive to growth. And thirdly, through very significant increases in aid, which will support these processes, including on debt relief. And I'll come back to that. The one dimension that is not mentioned in any of these compacts, which I would suggest is much more important than aid, certainly, is, of course, migration. And it's very interesting how, although we know that migration, historically, looking back, has been the main way that people have escaped poverty, and those of you that are in the room that are, whose parents or great-grandparents were migrants will know this. A third of Europe migrated in the 18th century and 17th centuries. Huge migrations of poor people across Africa. Huge migrations in other parts of the world. And that's not new. That's been around as long as globalization of communities and movement of communities has been around. But that was a very, very important way that people escaped poverty. The establishment of nation states, the carve-up of Africa through colonialism, the increasing sophistication of border controls, which really only happened about 100 years ago, passports being introduced and so on, and now the increasing sophistication and additional layers of security, has really stopped that traditional way of people moving towards where jobs and opportunities was and escaping persecution and so on. And so with that sort of off-the-center frame, we're focusing on these other things that rich countries can do. But I would suggest that anyone interested in development needs to keep their eyes and their mind on migration and migration debates and support more movement. A small change in the trade discussions on temporary movement of migration is likely to lead to much greater welfare gains than in many other areas that rich countries can do. So it's very important, and we should come back to issues of the brain drain and brain waste and so on associated with that, which is also highly significant. So the key elements that were agreed in this compact then from the rich country side were trade and aid, and as part of aid, increasingly, debt is coming into the picture. And how have we done in all of this? Starting with the rich countries, the key question is, has the macro management of the world been conducive? Now, we've gone through a period of stability. The average growth rates projected out of the developed countries, of the rich countries, is about 2.5% for the next 10 years, an average growth rate of around 5% for developing countries. So developing countries are both more stable in their growth rates and at higher levels on average over this projected period. And that's very important. It's good for the world economy, of course, but it also means that the global weight will change, so that by 2030, we move from about a quarter to about a third of global GDP being developing country, And by that time, certainly on a PPP basis, China will be the biggest economy in the world. Not long. And many of you will still be young when that happens. So global change is in balance, and hopefully with that, and I'll come back to it hopefully if there's time, some changes in global governance along with it. But these, on the global level, we are relatively sanguine. We believe that the main issues are in control, with one major caveat, and that, of course, is these historically unprecedented twin deficits in the U.S., on the fiscal side, on the external trade balance, and also a worrying tendency towards fiscal deficits and other deficits in the European Union and in other major economies. Now, why is this important for development? The traditional model of development, as you all know, is that at lower levels of development, you should be absorbing the world's savings. Your expectations of high growth should allow you to be absorbing a higher level of savings that you can mobilize domestically. And instead, and of course, at the higher levels of development, the reverse should be taking place. In other words, your savings should be exceeding your consumption in different dimensions. The irony, and for developing countries, the extremely worrying dimension of these deficits, particularly in the U.S., is that there's a south-north transfer of capital. And that, of course, is difficult at a time when the South should really be absorbing very large, or developing countries should on average be absorbing very large amounts of capital. So that on the global macro front is a very, very worrying tendency. And of course, what we're all looking to is a careful, measured unwinding of these positions, which doesn't destabilize the global system. So macro is one dimension. How are we doing on trade? Trade remains the most obscene of the policies, the most economically illiterate, as you will know if you study it, the most politically short-sighted, the most environmentally destructive, and the most socially ineffective form of intervention of the rich countries in the economy. The fact that rich world farmers are protected in different forms to the tune of about $300 billion dollars a year, which is six times aid, is really very difficult to explain logically. The fact that most of those subsidies go to a very small number of farmers, this is not protection for one's imagined goat farmers in Provence in the south of France. This is protection for very mechanized, chemical-intensive agriculture on average. It's for the cotton farmers in the U.S., the sugar farmers in Europe, and so on. It has an immensely destructive effect, not only on the social fabric and environment in the rich countries, but the reason we care about it, because that's not our mandate to care about the poor farmers, the reason we care about it is because it has an absolutely pernicious effect on the ability of poor people in developing countries to escape their poverty. The cost to West Africa of the cotton regimes is probably about $250 million, huge amounts of money. But more important than these costs, which we can measure, of the impact, are the dynamic growth impacts of these trade policies. The effect of these policies is to make investment in diversification out of the traditional commodities much more difficult. And in my previous job, for example, as the chief executive of the Development Bank of Southern Africa, we covered 14 countries. We invested in something like 20 projects designed to help agricultural and rural communities get out of traditional agriculture. Fish farming on Lake Kariba, flower farming in Tanzania, vegetable farming in Kenya, and so on. None of these projects was able to break into the European Union market because of the phytosanitary conditions, because of the costs of legal entry and in other areas. And they all ended up serving other markets or domestic markets. We had a project for camel cheese production in Mauritania for the camel farmers. It was unable to work because we couldn't get a tariff line that was acceptable with the European Union. And this absolute incoherence between aid and trade is something that that we all need to campaign about, and I hope Peter Mandelson comes and speaks to you soon and that you can talk to him directly about this. But it is extremely important, and I can get rather one track on it. It also is pushing down, I think, commodity prices because it's increasing the pressure on farmers to remain in sectors where they have access and minimizing that diversification. And of course, because of the subsidies in the rich country, it's choking demand because, for example, Coca-Cola no longer uses sugar, it uses high fructose corn syrup. People are turning off cotton onto synthetics because of relative prices and so on and so forth. So the demand side, and of course the effect on consumers in rich countries is negative too. It's highly regressive. Poor people spend a higher share of their income on basic foodstuffs, and those are, on average, 3 or 4 times the world price in their product, and so the products are inflated. It's very difficult economically to explain them. The way these things, of course, are explained is that they're doing good for the countryside, they're doing good for small farmers. One needs to go and look at the evidence carefully to see whether that's the case. We believe there are far more effective ways, if those are the goals, of achieving them through income support, through non-trade distortion, production support, and so on. So trade, huge, huge amounts still to be achieved. Once those things are achieved, we create market opportunities in the world. That is a necessary but not sufficient condition for growth. And anyone that still thinks that sort of trade opportunity automatically translates into growth, of course, needs to begin to unpack all the other barriers that remain. The lack of infrastructure, the lack of skills, the customs facilities, and all the other restraints. But in the medium term, with those sorts of investments, this is the most important thing the rich countries can do to help lift the average growth rates of developing countries. So trade is extremely important. Aid. Aid has gone down as a share of GDP. The rich countries all committed about 30 years ago to achieving 0.7% of the gross national income. They currently average 0.23% of their gross national income on aid. This has gone down from about 0.33% 10 years ago. At a time when the rich countries have never been better able to afford it because they've never been richer. At a time that the poor countries have never been better governed. It is an absolute scandal that the levels of aid have fallen. There is no excuse for doubling aid, for increasing aid. It's affordable. And that, of course, is important. It is the case that much aid in the past was wasted. The Congo received $10 billion in aid. Its per capita GDP halved over the period 1960 to 1995. And that has developed a large cynicism of aid. We believe that that is fundamentally a view trapped in the past, that aid now, particularly since the end of the Cold War, where aid was at that time, up to the Cold War, increasingly directed for political purposes, for non-economic purposes, not to where poor people lived and not to countries that could use the money effectively. But with the end of the Cold War, with the Millennium Development Goals, with everyone singing the same song amongst the donor community, and we really are, and we spend a lot of time making sure that we're coordinated, that we're not tripping over each other, that the Tanzanian ministers don't have to fill in 2,400 quarterly reports like they had to fill in 5 years ago, that they're not spending their days visiting projects and putting flags of different nations on the projects, but rather getting on with their jobs of running their governments and their projects from a macro point of view. There's been huge improvements in aid effectiveness, and aid is better targeted. And with that, we believe that aid is probably 3 times more effective than it was 10 years ago in terms of its impact on poverty reduction and growth. And there's really no excuse for aid not to be increased. Of course, aid to regimes that cannot use it is probably not a great idea. We know who the crooks are. We know when aid goes to Swiss bank accounts. And clearly, those people should not get more aid. But where aid is going to be mobilized behind governments that are doing the right thing, we believe it should be increased very rapidly. And certainly that is part of the campaign. The British government is in the lead in many of these matters and is committed to, if current trends continue, to increasing its commitment to finally get to the 30-year-old commitment of 0.7 in the year 2013. And I think 4 European governments have already achieved this. But this is very, very important. Where should the money come from? There's a long and hot debate on that topic at the moment. Everything from aviation taxes, capital flight taxes, transaction taxes, energy taxes, all sorts of other. IFF, of course, the UK proposal, the International Financing Facility, which is really a forward purchase of aid commitments. All of these are great ideas. The bottom line, though, is that governments can afford it if they want to do it. And the important thing is that aid flows fast. We know that if governments have the will, they can, at the click of the fingers virtually, do things. And we know that over $1 trillion a year is spent on military, that huge amounts are spent when it's geopolitically urgent. This is geopolitically urgent at the global level. And so it's very, very important that aid is, money is found, and that it's found now. Of course, the postponing of this not only postpones the achievement of the goals, but every minute in this game really does count. During the course of this lecture, something like 8,000 children will die of preventable diseases. This is really time-critical stuff, and being able to get money out, and being able to get things to where they will serve is extremely important. So the aid dimension is important, and particularly aid which is supportive of other reforms, and I'll come to that in a minute. Where does debt fit into this? This has become a very hot topic in recent months. It was, of course, with Jubilee, and Jubilee achieved a huge amount, including pushing in support of the HIPC initiative, Highly Indebted Poor Countries initiative. That has been a relative success, and something like $54 billion of aid has been written down in that process, and as a share of GDP, countries have managed to greatly reduce the amount of money they spend on aid, and a share of revenue, it's gone down from something like 25% of government revenue in those countries being spent on debt relief to 18%. And of course, any saving on debt relief, if the governments are managing their affairs wisely, can be applied to more productive purposes like to investments in education and health and so on. So that is extremely important. It is, money in the end is fungible, and that is very important. Increasing debt relief, we believe, should occur. We believe there's an urgent need for more debt relief. But we do insist on a number of things in this dimension. The first is that this is funded. In other words, that if people believe in debt relief, they have to pay with a checkbook. They cannot expect it just to come from a cancellation of obligations, particularly to institutions which are recycling that debt. The World Bank, of course, is a bank. We survive by getting back the money, and countries depend on us for future lending, that we do receive the money. They also require, and we're moving increasingly to a concessional model where much higher shares of our money that we give to poor countries will be more concessional. Maybe 30% of the money will be grants in future years. But this requires an income stream and an asset base, which is guaranteed by income flows. So the first question is, where's the money going to come from? And we really do believe that that needs to be additional. It cannot simply be diverted from existing aid commitments so that the Global Fund for HIV AIDS suffers because the money is being allocated to debt relief, or that our lending, concessional lending to a country suffers because of debt relief. So one question is, make sure that it's funded. The second is, make sure it goes to countries that will use it wisely. I think what we know from past records is that money, if it's used wisely, does support poverty reduction and growth. But there, of course, are still countries where money may not be used wisely. So in support of budget support programs in a broad framework which supports it. And thirdly, of course, we need to be mindful of the moral hazard and the capital markets dimensions of these. The moral hazard is that many countries have spent many years with great hardship repaying their debts. And what is the signaling effect to all these countries of just writing off debts now to, in a sense, latecomers, or those that haven't over these years so effectively managed their debts? And that's a very big issue. And if you speak, for example, or read the papers and things off the website of the South African government, you'll see these sorts of arguments, even in relation to apartheid-era debts. Now, these are very important considerations. The other is that the capital markets, where we hope the future access to money will come from, depend on signaling as well regarding behavior on debt. And it's unlikely that they're going to issue new capital to countries that they don't believe will repay their debts. So these are all manageable issues. We believe that mechanisms are being devised to manage them. We can talk about them in Q&A. But those are some of the complexities if one begins to unpack the debt relief debate. So I've talked about trade. I've talked about aid. I've talked about debt. I've talked about a little bit about migration and the global macro. Let me now turn to what developing countries themselves need to do. Of course, any amount of opportunity only makes sense if the developing countries themselves are managing their affairs in a way that will not only ensure growth, but that the growth benefits poor people. And inequality, growing inequality and inequity, of course, is a major concern. The really overwhelming good news to emerge from developing countries over the past 25 years is that this, not only is this happening, it's happened at absolutely unprecedented rates in global history. Now, over the last 30 years, life expectancy at birth has increased by about 20 years. That is just numbingly impressive. It must probably took 20,000 years before that for it to be achieved. And so you have this absolute leapfrogging in one critical dimension of measurement of development, the increase in life expectancy by 20 years. Absolutely phenomenal. Illiteracy among adults over the last 30 years has decreased from about 47% to around 30%. Also, huge step change, unprecedented in history to have that sort of step change. Really, really extremely impressive. And life expectancy at birth has also virtually doubled in most of the developing world over this period. So these are some of the dimensions of success. Of course, also critical is that the number of people living under a dollar a day on that measure has gone down over the last 20 years. We think from about 1.5 billion to about 1.1 billion. This, again, is unprecedented as far as we know in history, where poverty just increased and increased and increased with population increases around the world. So there's been this reversal in poverty, and that is a huge source of encouragement, that these things can happen. And anyone that is skeptical about poverty reduction and skeptical about development really hasn't looked at their history books and hasn't looked at the statistics. Things are done, things are achieved. There's real, incredibly good news out there. And that's why it's really important to fight even harder to do more, because it can be done, and that's the crucial thing. In Africa, which remains by far the most troubling region, there's also been much that's achieved. Although per capita income in Africa has not increased over the last 40 years, and that is up to the year 2000, from 1960 to 2000. Since 2000, it has begun to increase. And that, of course, is critically important for the world and for poverty reduction. That is where poverty appears to be in many dimensions, the most resilient, in a sense, to efforts to change. But there's many other dimensions of good news from Africa. Not only are a number of African countries, including Mozambique, Lesotho, Botswana, and others, Ghana, amongst the highest growth countries in the world, growing at around 8, 9, 10%, competing with China for first place amongst global growth. But also, there have been some other huge step changes in the last 20 years in Africa. I mean, obviously, the transformation of South Africa is something that we all think about in that context. But something like two-thirds of the African economies, African countries, have moved from being autocratic to democratic over the last 30-year period. Now, this is a step change historically. It is extremely important. On the macro front, the average inflation rate was around 14% 20 years ago. The average inflation rate is 5% now. That's another step change. And these, we believe, are stable changes. These are not variations around a trend. Of course, there will always be some variation. So there's much good news. The Africa Commission, which Tony Blair has convened, and of course, most more importantly, because it's an African-wide initiative, NEPAD, are really aiming to drive through the changes in Africa and to achieve these sorts of growth rates of 7%. But on some other dimensions of development, of course, very, very worrying signs. One out of six Africans dies before the age of 5, and life expectancy at birth has declined from 52 years in 1990 to 45 years now. mainly due to the ravages of HIV/AIDS. Now, those are obviously, for anyone interested in achieving the MDGs, extremely severe backward movements. So it's right that there's a particular focus on what Africa needs. It's right that there's a particular focus on supporting the African governments and African leaders that are making the sorts of changes that will drive change. And these are changes on multiple dimensions. They changes I've mentioned on the macro front, and this doesn't, of course, only apply to Africa. It applies equally to Latin America, Asia, and Eastern Europe. But they changes on the macro. We know now, although I don't think anyone believes in the Washington consensus anymore, that really is history. But we know that certain building blocks of that sort of understanding, particularly on the macro stability front, and getting your macro in balance is vital. And we think that some rich countries could learn that lesson too. But clearly the macro stability is something which is there. And there are very few countries, interestingly enough, for us at the World Bank and people like myself that engage in these conversations, there are very few places where we have conversations around the macro, which are in any way tough. Often we're encouraging countries to loosen up a bit, to create a little bit more fiscal space, and of course increase the revenue side. So macro is important. And then it's really a question of the hardware and software of development. The hardware, critically infrastructure. Anyone that has been in a developing country knows that this is where many of the impediments come. But infrastructure along all its dimensions, transport, communications, power, water, ports, airports, that is absolutely key. The amount of money required is way in excess of the amount of money available or currently allocated. This will require an increase of investment in infrastructure in developing countries on average of around 3 to 5% of GDP over the next 10 years to achieve the MDGs. That is a very significant investment. There was a period in which people believed that the majority of these investments would come from the private sector. I think that illusion has long vaporized. There's no way the private sector is going to fund the majority of infrastructure needs for developing countries. In certain sectors, like telecommunications, certain parts of the power sector, urban distribution, some independent generation, the private sector is still coming to the party, and there has been an upswing in private sector interest, again, after a decline over the last few years, in investing in in infrastructure. But that is very small compared to the needs, and particularly in Africa, particularly in rural communities, it's going to have to be governments that fund infrastructure. They're going to have to increasingly fund it in innovative ways. That means not only working out partnerships with the private sector and trying to maybe absorb some of the risks, but also, of course, with international community. And that is where aid is very, very, very important, to provide the sort of concessional finance to fund much of this infrastructure. So infrastructure, hardware, absolutely critical. Equally important is the software. Software is everything from developing the education systems, the skills, health systems, and the health capacity to the governance and management of the economy. We've been doing a whole lot of very interesting surveys, which if you go to our website, you'll see, on investment climate. And what is it that drives private investment in growth, employment creation? And invariably, there are issues which governments can influence and make a difference on, not only by providing the hardware so that people have power generated, have power and have transport and so on, but also through the software. Now, there's a huge variation between countries. Some countries, it costs something like 2% of an average annual income and can be done with one-stop shop in one day to start a business. And in other countries, and if you go to the website, you'll see them all listed, it takes 2 years and five times an average per capita income to start a business. Now, clearly that has a very different incentive fact, certainly on legal entry into the firm market and to establishing firms. And there are many, many other instances for domestic and foreign investors. What I would like to emphasize in this area is that what is critical is not to think about what will attract foreign investors, but what will make domestic investors, one's own population, invest in the country. The statistics are that something like $1.5 trillion goes to domestic investment from domestic people in developing countries, and about $150 billion is foreign investment. It's way on, and that's very, very skewed towards a small number of countries, as you know. Foreign investment is a nice to have, but it is not what's going to drive job creation, employment, and so on. It's very important at the margin, but it's 10% at most, and for most countries, only 2 to 3% of the story of what's going to drive it. And of course, with foreign investment needs to come a bundle, technology, skills, and many other things, market opportunities, and so on. So the real question for governments in developing countries is how do they make their own people invest in long-term assets, in employment opportunities, in entrepreneurial activity in their own countries? And here we need to worry about migration and the brain drain and capital flight. You know the statistics, the headline statistics, more African doctors outside Africa than in Africa, more teachers. The flight of capital, which is not measured, of course, because most of it is not reported, but is estimated to be extremely significant, like $10 billion a year or something. Now, driving much of this is also, of course, incoherence between aid and these dimensions. It really doesn't make sense for rich world governments to be investing in education facilities in developing countries and then to be recruiting their skilled nurses and doctors and so on back. And the UK government is trying to do something about this. But these are the sorts of coherence issues which are absolutely vital in developing human potential and software as they are in other areas. And of course, governance is important. The rule of law, honesty, integrity, transparency. It's particularly important in those countries which are highly dependent on mineral and extractive industries, which have a very high predilection to being able to keep the resource rents outside the country. So these are some of the very, very important dimensions that developing countries must engage in. But a number of them are. In fact, the overwhelming majority of developing countries are doing the right thing. And that is why you have seen this huge increase in growth and in poverty reduction in developing countries. There are a small group of developing countries who, of course, are mired in conflict and who are, in their policies, making themselves poorer. And those are countries which, in a sense, for someone in the shoes of someone working at the World Bank, are the most troublesome. Conflict is one particular sort of issue, and post-conflict, and how one prevents countries falling into conflict or engaging in conflict with other countries. And there's a lot to be learned from history. But one of the things that can be learned is that there's a very close relationship between peace, security, and development. Both at the extreme end, in other words, people with hope who think that they will be employed and their kids will be employed and treated decently in society are far less likely to blow each other up or blow up their neighbors than people who have absolutely no hope, who have no participation in society, no power in society, and who look forward to a lifetime of unemployment and misery. So the one dimension is hope and its relationship, and that's, of course, why development at the global security level is vital. But more broadly, we know that the way that economies are managed is extremely important in terms of the ability for those conflicts to manage tensions and overcome conflict. And of course, it's no accident that the majority of conflicts are in regions where groups have been able to capture rents. Rents from commodities, rents from mineral extraction, rents from particular sectors to fund conflict and arms. And so these things are very important and need to be managed at the local level, but of course at the global level. Again, it's a question of coherence between different dimensions of policy, coherence on global governance. We also know that some of the biggest advances that will be made will come in these dimensions. The biggest threat to development in the world is war. The biggest threat to people is that sort of dimension of conflict that just fundamentally takes off the floor from beneath where they stand. And so global governance, local governance around conflict prevention cannot be separated from any discussion of development. So too cannot other threats to the world. And of course, climate change is something which is the Prime Minister Blair has put on the agenda. But climate change is absolutely fundamental. I attended a meeting recently of small island states who literally are threatened by this in every dimension. And of course, it greatly increases the risks to rural populations. We know that the poor are most vulnerable. They're most vulnerable to climatic change. We know that the sorts of changes that are happening on the climate will increase the variability of rain, not necessarily make it less, but also on fewer days, harder downpours, and so on. And so when, for example, we're talking with the Indian government about major infrastructure investments in water, in irrigation, and so on now, we are looking at the modeling of what climate change will do to India. And it's dramatic in its impact. Allied to this is the need for global funding of new technologies. New technologies for plants which are not only richer in different dimensions, but able to resist this. And the CJIR, the Global Consortium around Agricultural Research, and this is not related to the GM debate, for those of you that want to pounce on me on that dimension. This is much more fundamental about enriched rice and so on, drought-resistant rice that goes back for 45 years, is absolutely fundamental. These are global public goods, but they become more important the more vulnerable people are to global threats. And so I want to end with a reference to the need for development to take place at absolutely all levels. It needs to take place at the national level. It needs to take place at the global level. And everyone has a responsibility in every level of their work, in their communities, in their countries, in their global politics. And when you sit in the UK, even if you're from another place, there's hundreds of ways in which you can engage in your daily lives to affect these things. But most important of all of these things, and I'm not saying this simply because I'm at LSE, if you go to the papers that I've written and talked about, this is a consistent theme. Most important is the power of ideas. What is it that explains why some countries have managed to move, that some aid systems are better than others, that some institutions evolve over time? And it's because of the contesting, the fighting around ideas, the constant churning and evolution of ideas. And I'm sure, although we think that we have many of the answers now, we will hopefully find, otherwise we really have to worry, that these ideas will be replaced by newer and better ideas in history of what makes development happen. And the areas which are particularly weak, the institutional reform area, is an area where we're just grappling to engage at the moment. The capacity ideas, these ideas around migration I've referred to, the ideas around the impacts of big global processes like climatic change. We're just beginning to get our hands onto them. But the more that we invest in research, the more that people like yourselves focus on development issues, the more optimistic I think we can be about development. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Golden. We still have about 15 minutes for questions. There's another group coming in at 3:30, so we need to wrap this up about 3:25 and move out so they can come in.
Do you want to sit down or should I stay here?
As you prefer. Stay. So I'll start back here. I think there's a microphone going around. I'll start at the back and then here in front and then over there. So at the very back there, that's right.
Yeah. Hello, Håkon Maas, my name. I'd like to ask about the relationship between the World Bank and the developing countries, and more especially about the future of conditionalities, for example. I've heard about swaps where the World Bank funds a whole sector of the government instead of single projects. Could you perhaps talk about what the World Bank is going to do to further increase the ownership of the relevant governments?
So, Ed, could we take two at a time, just to get some more in? There is another question here in front. Sorry, in the white sweater.
Hi, I think this one's related to the other one. It's again about the relationship between the World Bank and developing countries. With Jim Wolfensohn retiring this year, do you see any prospect that the next head of the World Bank won't simply be one of President Bush's old chums and might actually be chosen transparently and might not be an American citizen.
Well, I would clap if I wasn't a member of the staff. Should I take these two? Yeah. On the second point, not much hope now. There's a very good website called worldbankpresident.org, which if you're interested in these matters, you can look at. There's a global carve-up, as you know, of the financial system, particularly Bretton Woods institutions. And in it, the Europeans get the fund, the IMF. The Americans, that is to say, I'm falling the same trap I always don't like, which is the USA, not the South Americans or even Canada, get the call on the World Bank president, and the rest of the world fights over the WTO. That really remains in place, and because the Europeans recently insisted that they have the head of the IMF, they've perpetuated that process. Having insisted that the Europeans get the IMF, I think the Americans, or the US, there we go again, is likely to insist on the bank. Now, many of us dream, and maybe some dreams will come true, but I think it's unlikely. The really important thing is the sorts of things that, and the Guardian's written some really interesting editorials in recent weeks on this issue. It's the criteria for the job. I don't think the nationality is the most important thing. The most important thing is the quality of the woman or the man that's in the job, and that's obviously what we need to keep the focus on. But this is something which staff have absolutely nothing to do with other than reading the website. Like everyone else. The question of the relationship between the bank and the governments. This is a very positively evolving process. Mainly in recent years behind in the poorest countries, the PRSP processes, the bank is very much now aligned with donors. It has many, many advantages. It has the efficiency advantages. It has the coherence advantages. And it has the very significant advantage of basically supporting budgets in delivering goods. And, of course, because money is fungible, it really does lead to a coherent view across the economy as well as between the different aid donors of what's happening. So that is really where we are. Within the bank, we're also trying to ensure more coherence. You know, it's a bank group. So we have the International Finance Corporation, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Group within the bank group, across the different institutions, so that we're playing off the same sheet as well. And that's led to, I think, a very significant improvement as well. There's a long way to go. I don't for a second want to sound complacent, and that's one of the reasons why it's so important to have a leader that continues to drive change in the institution. There is a long way to go. But where it works, it's really working much better than where it used to work. I hope that answered your question. I wasn't totally clear, but catch me afterwards if I didn't.
Question here.
The awareness of the perverse nature of agricultural subsidies has been on the agenda for quite a long time now. From having worked in the agricultural sector in the UK and trying to work on sustainability side here, I'd be really interested to know why I'm fully against subsidies, but I welcome practical ideas about how they can be eliminated without huge economic problems over here.
Yeah,
Yes. Thank you for your talk. It was extremely interesting and quite optimistic. I thought it sounds like we should congratulate ourselves for what the Western governments have achieved over the last 20, 30 years. I thought it was very interesting what you said about the need for hope and the importance in countries where there is conflict to give hope to people. To improve their chances of developing. And I wondered how you reconcile, how you and how the bank reconciles this with the cynical determination of certain Western countries to destabilize the Middle East and the obvious effects on the rest of the south of the world. Thank you.
Yeah, you put me in a difficult position. we can again have the conversation afterwards. You know, the bank is owned by 184 different countries, and so we don't comment on any individual country's actions. And if I have, then I wasn't being effective in my job. But both of these questions are obviously go to the heart of rich countries' policies. I think on how to remove ag subsidies, you know, I've never really understood why they continue. The ag population accounts for something like 2, maybe 3% of the electorate and of economic activity. It really is a fantasy that urban voters are voting for, and when they vote for these subsidies, and it's through lack of knowledge and the fact that you all are paying. Most probably, you know, £500 a year more than you should be for your food because of these things. And that's, of course, at the cost of poor people in poor countries. It's just not appreciated, understood, campaigned around, and so on in an effective way. One sort of answer, and this is the most cynical answer, is in economic processes, basically, in market economies, there is an evolution, and the movement of agriculture is part of that. What happened to the coal miners in the UK? What happened to the textile workers 200 years ago? What happened to those? And if you constantly prohibit sectors declining, you are unlikely over the long term to. Particularly, and the only reason I feel strongly about this is because of the impact of the rest of the world. So they've chosen to defend in the most expensive way the sector which has the biggest effect on the rest of the world. Now, what we know from the decline of the coal industry, from the steel industry, and from many other industries, is that when governments want to do it, they do it. And all of those, by the way, certainly the coal industry represented more people at a time than benefit in significant ways from these subsidies. They do it through a whole series of different means, through providing a safety net, through reskilling on jobs, through different diversification strategies. And I think that's more possible in the countryside. The important thing, I think, is to get behind the numbers. Who actually benefits from these subsidies? Is it the people we imagine? Is it the small farmers? I've seen evidence which suggests that these subsidies push small farmers off the land because they capitalize the land. They go for large-scale mechanized production and so on. So one is, what are these subsidies actually doing? Who are they supporting? How many people get them? And there's websites in the U.S. that have this information, and you see the farmers, like the Rockefellers, they get millions of dollars, even though they live in New York. I think I've just cited the wrong name. But that's one sort of question. That information doesn't exist transparently in Europe, as far as I'm aware. So one question, but government should know this, is who gets the subsidies? Then you can begin to target the impact of the withdrawal. The second is to think of the secondary things you can do. Clearly, rural tourism, managing the countryside to improve the environment, organic farming, et cetera, and one can imagine all those sorts of things to the people that you want to target. If what our objective is to make the countryside beautiful, to keep a number of people living in the countryside because we believe it's the right thing for society, because we want to keep the countryside beautiful, because it's good for the environment, and of course to produce agriculture that is competitive, that's what they should do. But not at the cost of poor people in developing countries. And of course, all rich countries have the right to put their tax money wherever they want to put it. But our concern is the impact on the rest of the world. The question of the coherence of policies on the Middle East, I'll rather pass on. But clearly, it's absolutely vital that the investment in peace is made. That is, in ensuring that governments support opportunities for peace when they arise, to create employment and to give reformers within the region who are investing in peace the opportunity to deliver something, particularly to be able to deliver jobs and hope for people. And that is a very large part of what we engage in. We engage in very significant investments in the West Bank, for example, and Gaza, in basic infrastructure, water, sanitation, basic infrastructure, and then in dimensions, which we hope will create
opportunity. But these things can only be as good as the overall enabling environment. Clearly, if there's war, it's difficult to do anything.
Mm-hmm. In the back there, in the white sweater, please. And then down here in the back.
Is this on? Yeah. What's the relationship between continuing to prioritize growth and counteracting global warming? Surely this is something that the world has never faced before and perhaps requires some new thinking.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It does require new thinking. Clearly, there's a very long debate, and I see we've run out of time, so it's impossible to get into these things. But the projections and the associations of energy intensity and growth in energy consumption based on what is needed to overcome poverty will inevitably lead to much higher emissions. And of course the debate is, A, how does one reduce the energy intensity of that growth? How does one ensure a much greater use of renewables? And our funding for renewables is going to double in the coming years. What sort of bargain at the global level does one create around that? And you'll be as familiar as I will with developing countries' insistence that their growth is not stopped to pay for the past emissions, in a sense, of those countries which are now rich. I see that as absolutely one of the most difficult intellectual issues that we face in the development community, is how do we achieve the poverty reduction and growth, which we believe is absolutely critical, in a way that will be mitigated to the absolute maximum through new mechanisms, new technologies, and less intensive in terms of energy ways. It's absolutely essential, and it's related to other questions. We know one of the greatest causes of death is indoor air pollution from coal, for example, and those sorts of questions are clearly related to how does one move off coal and what does one move to, and so on. I just want to clarify one number that I gave you, which is wrong. Is while I've been talking, 800 people have died from preventable diseases, not 8,000. It's 19 a minute. Well, actually, I have talked for longer. Thank you.
I'm afraid we have to wrap it up. It's now past 3:25. So thank you very much to Dr. Rowland. Let me hand the floor over quickly to Verena, the president of the Student Society, to tell you about upcoming events the rest of the week.
I would like to thank Mr. Golden very, very much for finding the time to come and speak to us. And just very quickly, I'd like to invite you all to our last panel discussion today, which will take place at 5 o'clock in H102 on health aspects of the Millennium Development Goals, as well as our fundraising auction in the Quad tonight at 7:30, where we're going to be auctioning dates with LSE students, as well as Howard Davies, Danny Kwar, and a couple of other more famous favorites from LSE. So please come. All the money that's raised going straight to WaterAid. Thank you.